WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as the Mediterranean diet and European horse meat dominate the food headlines, the Museum of Natural History has a new exhibit on foods from around the world, many of which we could be eating but don't even know they exist. Joining me now is Dr. Eleanor Sterling, one of the curators of the American Museum of Natural History's current exhibit, Our Global Kitchen, Food, Nature, Culture. She's also the director of the Museum Center for Biodiversity and Conservation. Welcome back to WNYC, Dr. Sterling.
Thank you very much.
And we noticed that both the Museum of Natural History, where you work, and the Smithsonian Institution down in Washington have big exhibits on food right now. Do you think this is an especially good moment to think deeply about food for some reason?
Absolutely. And the New York Public Library just had a wonderful exhibition on lunches in New York City, too. So, yes, I think that people are really paying attention to food in a way that they haven't in the past. People are thinking about what they eat and how that relates to their bodies, to their health, as well as to the health of the environment. And so we felt this was a wonderful moment for us to try to present some of the science behind the information that is available to us all through our life and through our media, to try to help people cut through some of the stories and help us to better understand how we get what on our plate from farm to fork.
And there are parts of this exhibit that look at the past in a fun way, for example, showing what Jane Austen's dining room might have looked like or what Emperor Augustus's wife might have eaten in ancient Rome. But you also look forward to the future of food. Are we talking about what used to be science fiction, test tube meat and skyscraper farms and things like that?
Yeah, if you want to call that science fiction, then at this point in the past, I think people were really thinking those were fanciful. But at this point, we have a lot of really wonderful and interesting potential innovations that could help us think about how we will feed the future of the human population. You know, we'll likely be 2 billion more people by 2050, and thinking about how we produce that and distribute that to be able to make sure that everybody has access to sufficient food is challenging.
And so your exhibit along those lines shows lab-grown meat, affectionately known as schmeat, which we've talked about on the show before, and food skyscrapers, which could help grow large amounts of food in urban areas, literally using many levels in a building with the right kind of windows and everything. And you have a working window farm at the exhibit. So for our listeners who maybe haven't seen one of these installations elsewhere, how does a window farm work?
Yeah, you know, the principles are pretty straightforward. You can take a plastic bottle and turn it upside down and put some clay pellets at the base of that, and then run a water system through that and plant some plants and really grow food just in your window. And there's a wonderful opportunity to look that up online to do some do-it-yourself window farms. And that allows you to have food at your fingertips and even in small spaces, like those of us who live in tiny apartments in New York City and don't have the opportunity to have an acre farm out in the backyard. And so it's really a hydroponic system, a system that runs on water and not necessarily using soil in the same way you might if you're growing in your backyard.
The exhibit points out that almost half of our food calories come from just three grains, wheat, maize, corn, and rice. But there are over 2,500 plant species that have been domesticated for food somewhere in the world. There are a few underutilized plants that you point out could even change the way we eat, starting with algae. Why algae?
You know, algae is actually pretty easy to grow. You can grow it in both salt water and fresh water. And it's also very nutritious. And so people have been eating algae for a long time. In fact, we have this wonderful part of the exhibition where we look at an Aztec market in Mexico just before the Spaniards came, and we thought about what people were eating then, and algae was featured prominently there. So it's something we see in our sushi rolls, of course, but it's also something that people have used in various places through time and could be scaled up in our diets.
You know, we could take some phone calls from listeners over the next few minutes, maybe make this one of our Immigrants from Anywhere segments. Listeners, if you think that you're familiar with a food from another culture, maybe from the country you were born in, that could be more commonly used as part of the Western diet, what might that food be? What did you bring with you in terms of a food habit that people here just may not be familiar with, but that could diversify our diets? Make it healthy, 212-433-WNYC, or make it fun, 212-433-9692. Not that healthy foods can't be fun. 212-433-9692 as we talk to Dr. Eleanor Sternberg, one of the curators of the Museum of Natural History's current exhibit, Our Global Kitchen, Food. Dr. Eleanor Sterling, I should say, exhibit, Our Global Kitchen, Food, Nature, Culture. So we mentioned algae as an example of something that people around the world eat. Insects are on the list, too, and apparently there are over 2,000 species of insects that are actually eaten worldwide.
Yeah, absolutely. Beetles, butterflies, locusts. For the most part, for the smaller insects, people eat those, you know, when they're in their larval stages or their pupal stages. So a lot of people don't think that sounds appealing, especially here in the United States. But if you think of shrimp or even lobsters, those are things that we've learned to like, and our culture believes is wonderful and tasty. And it's really a matter of mind in some of these issues. And if we were able to eat the insect larvae, many insects reproduce very quickly. They're easy to raise, and sometimes they have really big larvae that are shrimp-sized and similarly tasty.
Today we're talking about insects being palatable. Maybe tomorrow it'll be IKEA horse meatballs, who knows? But let's stay on the foods that at least are properly labeled around the world, accurately labeled for what they are. Ben in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ben, you got one?
Yeah, I want to know about amaranth. I've heard that's one of the most nutritious grains around, and I'm wondering why it's not more popular.
Thank you. And is amaranth represented in the exhibit, Dr. Sterling?
We talk about it briefly. It is very important. It's a very useful and interesting plant that's grown in various places around the world, sometimes in places far outside of what was originally grown. But, basically there aren't markets that really support amaranth at this point. They're growing. You can see amaranth flakes in the grocery stores now, more so than before, and there are people that are really recognizing the nutritional importance of the species and trying to think about how to grow it in various places. So I think that that's picking up in places around the world, but it certainly is one that we should keep our eye on because it is nice and nutritious and tasty.
Another one kind of like that is quinoa, which a lot of people know about by now. Mm-hmm. But another one in the exhibit, less known, is emmer wheat, E-M-M-E-R, wheat. What's emmer wheat?
Well, it's a variety of wheat. Essentially, there are many, many varieties of wheat, and it's a variety of wheat that is not grown as much as other wheat varieties around the world, but it actually is one that we should be thinking about in the future as we think about climate change, because it can grow in some marginal environments, such as drier environments, than the wheat that we traditionally grow right now at large scales.
David in Hopatcong is calling in. Hi, David. You got one?
Yeah, sure. How's it going?
Good. What food are you thinking of?
I think coconut oil is something that many people don't know about that could probably be used much more frequently in our cooking and our baking. It's just a much healthier substitute for some of the oils we do use.
Thank you very much. Is coconut oil in the exhibit?
We don't actually we don't go to that level of different oils in the exhibition. Mm-hmm. It'd be wonderful if we had the space to do that. But there are a lot of nutritious foods around the world. One of the things we need to think about is how are those foods grown and what does it take to produce those foods in various places around the world, which is one of the reasons why the insects and algae can be more environmentally friendly. There's some oils that are grown around the world that are problematic for the environment.
And if insects are a protein that we don't eat much of in this country, Patrick on Long Island has another one. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What you got?
Goats.
Uh-huh.
Goat meat, goat milk. It's something I grew up with, you know, and it's another alternative for, like, beef and chicken that I don't see really catching on here in the U.S.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I don't know why, or if you know, Dr. Sterling, why goat meat is less used here. You can get it. I was in a restaurant the other week that had goat on the menu. Goat milk yogurt is very good. I've had that. So why so many cows and not so many goats?
Well, and goat cheese, of course, is delicious,
right.
And we are starting to eat more of the goat cheeses and milk products, as you say. You know, it's all a matter of culture and what people grow in their farms and what people ask for in the marketplace, and all these things really are about, if people are interested in goat meat, checking with your grocer, checking with your restaurant, asking for it, and seeing if people hear that it's something somebody wants to taste and that people find tasty, it'll become more and more part of our markets.
Earlier this hour, we talked about the Mediterranean diet, which recommends 3 or more servings of fish per week. We've been hearing a lot about the problem of overfishing for years now from an environmental standpoint. And your exhibit shows how next-generation fish farms could address environmental concerns about fishing. And yet I don't think fish farms are considered so environment-friendly or health-friendly necessarily today. So what are next-generation fish farms?
Well, I think that all of our fish farms are doing a better job, and regulations are starting to think more about what happens when you're growing those fish in those areas. If you're growing fish in an ocean, for instance, in a pen in the ocean, there's a potential for pollution and some problems in some parts of the world. And for the native species that live around those fish farms. So one option that people are starting to think about is closed fish farms, where they're basically growing fish in water systems that aren't actually connected up to lakes, rivers, or oceans. And that way you can really regulate the amount of nutrients that go in and clean the water and keep it healthy. So another thing that's happening right here in New York City is something called aquaponics, where people grow fish in a tank, and then the water from the fish water that's fertilized by the fish poop goes into a filtration system that then feeds a garden. And so you have a system where the refuse or the nutrients from the fish actually then grow carrots or lettuce or something else. So it's a closed system that actually uses a waste from one to mm-hmm. feed another one. So that's happening in a lot of different places, in basements of churches and schools here in New York City.
Let's get one more example from a listener of a food that they brought from elsewhere or ate when they were growing up. Dree in Madison, New Jersey. Hi, Dree.
Hi, Badri here. So I want to talk about millet, which is used in many parts of India as an ancient grain.
Mm-hmm, right, one of the grains, millet, yep.
Yeah, so millet is it has good health benefits, and it's organically grown. It can sustain harsh weather, so basically doesn't need use of excessive pesticides or any other, so it generally can be organically grown. So that's something that I would like to bring out.
Millet, thank you very much, Dree. And it is funny, Dr. Sterling, as you point out, there are just 3 grains that are so commonly used in this country, rice and corn and wheat. But there are other ones like millet. I've had millet cereal, barley. There are other things, but we just don't use them. Is it all economics?
A lot of it's economics. It's really about efficiency and trying to identify ways to grow foods that grow quickly, and you can make a profit really quickly from them with efficiency in the system. I think those systems sometimes forget about the downsides to some of the industrialized single crops that we grow, particularly in the United States, but elsewhere around the world too. And we're really speaking in the exhibition about diversified farming and including more kinds of grains and more kinds of crops and animals mm-hmm. in a farm, so that you basically support diversity. And it's also good in, again, as we're facing a changing weather in the future, that if something happens to one of your crops on the farm, another one might thrive under the new conditions. So it's better for our bodies and better for our environment to be thinking about diversifying.
So the exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History is called Our Global Kitchen, Food, Nature, Culture. One of the curators is our guest, Dr. Eleanor Sterling. She's also the director of the Museum Center for Biodiversity and Conservation. And we're out of time, but I'll just throw in one more fun thing from the exhibit. I see you have the section on the biology of taste, and there's an experiment that people can do right there. You give folks a jelly bean, and they hold their nose and eat it to see how much smell is related to taste, right?
Yeah, it's a great experiment. Stop by and see it. The exhibition's open until August 11th this year.
Dr. Sterling, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us.